1980s and early 1990s, when I traveled to various Latin American countries, almost everyone I met was enthusiastic about privatization. And people in government, people in business, people in other walks of life were only too happy to tell me and others about activities that had already been privatized and what had yet to be done. Since then, there has been a major change in attitude. And on that, I think there's good news and bad news. And let me just start this afternoon with the bad news. For Latin America generally, 70% of the population, according to opinion polls, now think that privatization is a bad idea. They have an unfavorable or negative view of privatization. And that ranges from a high of 86% of everyone in Argentina, which is probably privatized the most in Latin America next to Chile, down to 60% in Ecuador. So the most favorable place for privatization today is in Ecuador, but 60% of all Ecuadorians think it's a bad idea. What's even more disturbing is that this trend has been worsening over time. Even in Chile, which is the country that has gained the most from privatization, benefited enormously and has the highest standard of living of any country in Latin America, and really is a model and a show place for the entire continent. In Chile in 1998, 41% of the population had a negative view of privatization. By the year 2000, it was 58%, and by 2002, it was 78% had a negative view. So from 10 years ago, there's been a flip-flop, a sea change in attitudes in Chile. In Argentina, it's gone from 48% against to 67% to 86%, and similar numbers are revealed in polls in other Latin American countries. And this is serious, and this change in public opinion has led to the cancellation of a number of privatization projects in Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Costa Rica, Panama, Peru, and elsewhere. Now, economists have studied the effects of a number of privatization efforts in Latin America, and by and large, the economic studies find that privatization has had good effects. In other words, it has improved quality, it has lowered price, it has improved equity, and in particular, the privatization of the utilities, telephone, electricity, water. We have pretty good studies that show that people have gained, and the gains are especially pronounced for the low-income people. You know, even in the old days, high-income people could get their telephone, but people at the bottom of the income ladder would have to wait 6 months, a year, or even longer to get their telephone. So at the bottom is where the gains have been the highest. And yet, when we look at the opinion polls, it's people in the lower classes, self-described, lower income groups, have also a very negative view of privatization. Again, Chile, which has done the most privatization, low income groups in Chile, 58% have a negative view of privatization. Argentina, 62%. It's not uniformly bad. In Brazil, among the low-income population there, only 20% have a negative view of privatization. So it's not all bad, but by and large, it doesn't look good. Why is it that this negative view persists? Why has it gotten worse over time, despite the economic studies showing that that privatization works, that it's had beneficial effects, that it lowers costs, increases quality, increases access, and reduces inequities, is especially good for lower income groups. It's hard to put your finger on one single factor, but a number of people have pointed to the fact that that many people see in privatization unfairness, and they believe that government officials and private industry have gained more from the privatization than other people, and especially low-income people. And it's sometimes compared to the ultimatum game, which is a game theory game that's often played in experimental labs just to see how people will respond. And the ultimatum game works like this. You have $100 to distribute, and you have two people. And one of the players, the player that goes first, gets to allocate the $100 between the two people. and the other party gets to say whether he accepts or rejects the offer. If he accepts the distribution, then the two leave with the money. And if the second person rejects the offer, then they leave with nothing. So if I'm the person who goes first and we have $100, I might say, well, I'll distribute $50 to me and $50 to you. On the other hand, I might say, I'll distribute $75 to me and only $25 to you. Now, if you think like an economist, you think that regardless of what you're offered, if you walk away with something, it's better than nothing, so you should accept. So even if I say $90 for me or $10 and only $10 for you, that's $10 you wouldn't otherwise have, and so you should walk away $10 happier. Or if I say $95 and $5, you should accept that offer as well, because that's $5 you wouldn't otherwise have. But the fact of the matter is that's not how people respond. The idea of only getting $5 doesn't offset the disgust on the part of the second person of knowing that I unfairly am going to walk away with the other $95. So what happens is the second person rejects that offer. In fact, they reject all kinds of offers that that are too much tilted in favor of me in this example. And as a matter of fact, you can't go much beyond 60-40 before you get a very high probability that your offer is going to be rejected. So all this shows in laboratory experiments with people that people don't act like the rational economic man of the textbook. And that even when they're gaining, they may not like an improvement in their lives if they think that the benefits are unfairly distributed. I don't know if that's what's really going on, but it's an idea. Something else that's going on in Latin America is a basic distrust of institutions, and this goes for the institutions that are created through privatization, but also is there for government-run institutions. Public opinion polls worldwide show that in developed countries, when asked the question, can most people be distrusted, about 44% of the people say yes. It's not more than half, but it's 44% is a lot higher than it is in the less developed world, where only one out of four people say that most people can be trusted. In Colombia, only one in 10 say most people can be trusted. In Peru, it's 5%. In Brazil, it's 3%. So clearly, there's a difference across cultures and countries in the trust that people have. In any event, the disgust for privatization is not only apparent in general public opinion, but also in the statements of leaders that revel in opposing the United States, Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales. Daniel Ortega said yesterday that the fall in the stock market was God's punishment to the United States for all the evil things we had done. And what he means by evil things is trying to get other countries to adopt our way of life. That's the bad news. What's the good news about Latin America? The good news is that Latin America has succeeded in privatizing some of the most difficult institutions there are to privatize, and in particular, entitlements programs, and especially retirement pensions. And there was a time when it was believed in the United States and elsewhere around the world that you just couldn't, in a democracy, privatize a pension system. But in fact, Latin America has had major success in doing so. In Chile, Mexico, Bolivia, and El Salvador, they already have or are in the process of replacing completely a public pay-as-you-go pension system with a private funded individual account system. In Argentina, Uruguay, Costa Rica, and Ecuador, there is a two-tier system now, a public pay-as-you-go system, but a private funded system on top of it. In Peru and Colombia, people are given a choice between a pay-as-you-go public system and a private system. What all this means is that Latin America is way ahead of the rest of the world, with a possible exception of Eastern Europe, in dealing with what is now the world's most difficult problem. And the most difficult problem is entitlements programs for the elderly. They've dealt with the pension side of that. They haven't dealt with the healthcare side. In fact, no country has really dealt with the healthcare side of that. More about that in just a moment. But this is a remarkable political success and has economic payoff. when you think about pension systems, you have to think over periods of time. And a good way to think about Latin American pension systems is to ask where they'll be by mid-century when today's college students will be reaching the retirement age. And you could ask, well, what will the unfunded liability be for the government in 2050 under the current reform system versus what would it have been under the old system? And in Chile and Peru and Uruguay and El Salvador, those countries by 2050 will have more than cut their unfunded liability in half. So that's major, major progress. In Mexico, by the time they reach mid-century, the reform system will have a third of the unfunded liability that it would have had had they stuck with the old public system. And in Bolivia, it's 1/7 of what it would have been. Additionally, these privatized pension systems are building up private capital. And in Chile, the funds in the private accounts is now more than half of the annual GDP of the country. And from 1998 to the year 2002, in that five-year period, the other countries that have reformed their system have doubled the size of their private account holdings relative to their national income. One criticism you're going to hear of Chile is that not everybody's in the system. And so a lot of people are going to reach the retirement age and they will not have saved enough to provide a decent pension. And they'll either have to receive a minimum pension from the government or they may get no pension at all. What's often not said by the critics is that throughout all of Latin America, most people are not in any pension system, public or private. And the reason for that is because huge percentages of the population are in agriculture or they're in the informal sector. Now, even in the United States, when we started our Social Security system, we exempted agriculture. And that's common all over the world. Chile, as it turns out, has a higher percent of its population participating than any other Latin American country. In Mexico, fewer than half of the people are participating in any pension system. In Colombia, it's 1 in 5, Peru, 1 in 10, Argentina, 1 in 3, Bolivia, 1 in 10. So in all of these countries, participation tends to be much smaller than you would think, just looking at the system on paper. Now, let me say a few words about the problem that developed countries are going to face and what we can learn, in fact, from Latin America. Some of you have heard me say before that the growth of government in the 20th century primarily came about in order to protect middle-class people against risks. There are certain risks that people have always faced, and they include the risk of living too long and not being able to support yourself during retirement, or dying too soon and not leaving resources to provide for your family and your loved ones, or becoming disabled and not being able to support yourself and earn an income. Or needing health care and not being able to afford it, or becoming unemployed and not having skills that the market wants. And these risks have been around for as long as human beings have been around. But until the 20th century, humanity had a way of dealing with them. And before you get to the 20th century, how is it that the average person insured against these risks? You had a family, right? You had a family, an extended family. Children were viewed as an investment in your retirement pension. Hard to believe that people once thought this way, but in the 19th century, the average child was paying his own way by the age of 12. And so having children was an investment, not only an income for the household, but also as an investment in your retirement years. Well, then we get in the 20th century, and families begin to... the family ties begin to loosen and people move away and people don't have as many children, and what children they have don't feel the way that children in the past had. In any event, this idea of a family as an insurance system begins to deteriorate. Now, it isn't entirely gone. I mean, even today, families help families. It's a very, very important social institution, but it wasn't enough. And so government steps in to do all of those things I just mentioned, provide insurance for old age, for sickness, for disability, for unemployment, and so forth. And if you think about why governments got big and why governments are today big and getting bigger, it really has to do with all of those programs that we set up. So we get to the end of the 20th century, and we learned that for the most part, in the developed and less developed world, Whenever we're talking about the elderly, all these programs are really Ponzi schemes. And they're organized like chain letters. And so we collect taxes, we spend the money immediately. Nothing is saved, nothing is invested. And so here we're sitting at the first decade of the 21st century, and the Social Security trustees in the United States tell us that we've got an unfunded liability in Social Security and Medicare of in excess of $100 trillion, about 6 to 7 times the size of our national income. And that doesn't even count Medicaid, and seniors use a disproportionately large share of Medicaid money. Or if you want another way of looking at it, if you ask, well, starting today, if we wanted to get out of this system and do what the Latin Americans have done, if we wanted to get out of this system and move to a system where each generation pays its own way, I mean, what would it take? And here's my back of the envelope calculation for your benefit. We need 4% from every worker for the retirement pension, so 4% to replace Social Security every year in the bank and an account. We need another 4% for Medicare. And we need probably 2% for Medicaid to cover the nursing home expenses and expenses for people who are in poverty or near poverty. That's 10% of income. Now, if we put that in the bank every year, we will get out by mid-century, and we probably will have solved the problem. We'll have a tax burden in the year 2050 no greater than the tax burden that we have today. But think about that for a moment in terms of how hard or inconvenient this would be. 10% of income just to provide for your own future retirement needs. And then that's just a minimum. On top of that, we still think people should put 5% in a 401k every year. So that's 15% that people need to be putting aside for their own needs. Now, on top of that, we have a 15% payroll tax, right? And all that goes to somebody else's retirement. So you have 15% for somebody else and 15% for yourself. That's 30% off the table. That's 30% you haven't consumed. And we still haven't taken care of the baby boomers. And since I'm a baby boomer, I want you to take care of me. And what is that going to take? Well, I'm going to guess that another 2 or 3 decades, we're going to need 10% of your income to take care of the baby boomers along the way. So what I'm talking about is a world in which people are going to have a lot less of their income to consume than people have in the past. And I'm talking about ideal solutions. I mean, if you don't do it the right way, if you don't do it quickly, then it just gets worse and worse. In any event, Latin America is way ahead of the other countries in getting this done. I don't think they're going to turn around and undo what they've done in that respect. They still haven't dealt with the health care problem. And just to give you some idea of how big it is, in the United States, when the trustees tell us there's $100 trillion of unfunded liability in Social Security and Medicare, the Medicare part of that is 5 or 6 times greater than the Social Security part. So health care is going to be the big elephant in the room. Okay, I promised to give a few of my overview thoughts and then turn to people who really know something about what's going on in Latin America. And our first speaker this afternoon is Gerald Driscoll. He's worked for almost everybody. Including the Heritage Foundation, where he was very involved in developing the Index of Economic Freedom, which is still going on. It's published annually. He, for a while, was in Dallas working for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. He worked for Citigroup. You see him from time to time on TV. You see his op-eds and the Wall Street Journal and other places. And he writes as well for professional journals. So please join me in giving a warm welcome this afternoon to Gerald Driscoll.